Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're continuing our study in the Servant Songs of Isaiah. Today we're going to be in chapters 51 and 52. We're going to be dealing with a paragraph in each one to try to set the stage for next week's lesson of Isaiah 53. Now, in the chapters immediately preceding this, God has been talking to the rebellious nations, are the unbelieving group of the nation of Israel. But in chapter 51, he's going to turn now to the believing, faithful remnant. And in 51:1, we find this beautiful designation of this faithful remnant with inside Israel. We must remember that even in the Old Testament, when salvation is seen in a corporate sense as a nation chosen by God, it was never every individual within that nation that was right with God, but it was only those who trusted God by faith. As Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness, so the individual Israelite who participated personally in the covenant was right with God. And so we have a description of that faithful remnant in Isaiah 51:1. Listen to me, you who, and then there's two qualifications, pursue righteousness, and number two, who seek the Lord. And I would add a third qualification from this same context. In verse 7 it says, whose law is written on their heart. And so I think these are the three descriptive phrases for the believing remnant. Now, let's see if we can find out what this exactly involves. This pursue righteousness. Now, this is not so much an emphasis on justification by faith. This is more an emphasis on justification by personal response. Now, I think there's two theological poles in the Bible that must be recognized, else it causes great problems, and that is salvation and the Christian life, or justification by faith and then sanctification, or the walk of faith. If we miss those two up, we're really going to confuse the biblical doctrines. Now, I think here we're talking about the Christian life. We're not saying that these people pursuing righteousness or these people seeking the Lord is the basis of their salvation, but it is the validity. It is the characteristic. It is the normal byproduct of being in a relationship of faith with God. Because they've been saved by grace, because they've been justified through faith, their lives are going to exemplify these kinds of things. Now, this pursuing righteousness is a biblical theme. It is first in Deuteronomy 16:20, so it goes back to the Mosaic Covenant. It is used several times in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 15:9, Proverbs 21:21, and it's repeated by the Apostle Paul two times in the pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy 6:11 and 2 Timothy 2:22. And so it's a very common concept in the Christian faith, in the idea one is objective truth and the other is experiential truth. We are saved because of our relationship to God through His grace. But because we're saved, we ought to pursue righteousness. We're right as far as position. Now we need to be right as far as lifestyle. And that's the idea here. It reminds me a lot of Ephesians chapter 6, where God provides His people with the armor for a Christian soldier, but the Christian must take up the armor and apply it to their lives. This is the idea here. Now, the second, who seek the Lord. This is the idea of those who actively are seeking that relationship, that personal relationship with the covenant God of Israel. And then I'll deal with verse 7 when I get there, which I think is the third characteristic of these believers. Now, then it says, look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug. Now, this is an emphasis going back to the covenant promises. We must remember that since Isaiah 40, we've been dealing not with the scene or the circumstances of Isaiah's own day, which is the reign of Hezekiah, but we've been looking further down the line during the time of exile, the Babylonian exile that occurs much later in Israel's history. Now, what we're mentioning here about the rock and Abraham and all that, it was terribly difficult for the Jews to understand why God would break His covenant. they felt like they were doing religious things. They were offering sacrifices. They were keeping the ceremonial law, but they had forgotten the attitude and the motives that God so desperately sought from his people. And so it really puzzled them why God let Jerusalem be destroyed and why God took the Davidic king from the throne. These are promises that they would never, never be taken away, and yet God took them away. And it caused the people to wonder if God really loved them, if God really cared for them, if there was any hope for the covenant ever being reestablished. And that's why a verse like this, what God's saying is, look back to that promise of Abraham. The rock here, it's many times a title for God in the Psalms and in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians 10:10, or maybe it's 2 Corinthians 10:10, it's a title for the Messiah. But here it simply refers to Abraham. It's the ideal of lineage, that patriarchal lineage to which these faithful Jewish people belong. Now, also, by mentioning Abraham and Sarah, remember, they are held captive in Babylon. Well, that's where Abraham was first called. Remember, way down there in the Chaldean place, Ur of the Chaldees, that's where God first spoke to Abraham. That's in the general area of where the children of Israel were captive. And so God is saying, as I called Abraham from this geographical location, as I called him, and it was just one person to be the father of a great nation, I know where you are, I know you're small, I know you're discouraged, but as I built a nation out of one man, I'll build a nation after you. And that's exactly what the promise is here. Now when it says, Sarah, who gave birth to you in pain, this is an obvious allusion back to Genesis 3:16. These people had sinned, and the consequence of their sin they were bearing in their lives. Sarah, though the mother of great promise and a part of the covenant, still had that curse from Genesis on her childbirth. And so I think that it's an allusion here to, though sin is a part of us, the promises of God can still be in effect. Now, then it says, when he was one, I called him. There's the emphasis on the smallness of the promise in Abraham's time. It looked so impossible that these few remaining Jews could ever be a great nation again, yet God promises them that. I blessed him and multiplied him. Now, if you want to see these initial covenant promises, go to Genesis chapter 12 and through chapter 15, where God promises to make his descendants as the sand of the sea, the stars of the heaven, the dust of the earth. That's the allusion here, that he's going to build a great nation out of this few remaining faithful covenant people. Now, verse 3. Indeed, the Lord will comfort Zion. Now, the word Zion is used through here in a symbol or a metaphor for the entire people of God. Now, Zion is a mountain in Jerusalem. It is not the mountain the temple is built on. The temple is built on Mount Moriah, where Abraham offered Isaac. But Mount Zion is right next to it. In modern-day Jerusalem, it is the location of the tomb of King David, traditionally. So, but it came to be a synonym for the entire Jerusalem area, and which included the temple, but it also came to be a symbol or a metaphor for the entire Jewish people. Now, here where it says, the Lord will comfort, it's the ideal about bringing an end to the captivity. It's the ideal of reestablishing the covenant blessings. And we're going to mention those blessings in the rest of verse 3. You might want to go back and read Deuteronomy 28. Really, 27 and 28 set the stage of the cursings on Mount Ebal and the blessings on Mount Gerizim. If the people were faithful, God would bless them. If they were unfaithful, God would curse them. That's what's been happening to the life of Israel. And now here's the promise of renewed blessings. He will comfort her waste places, and her wilderness will he will make like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. You see, physical blessing, physical beauty, physical fruitfulness was a sign of God's love and covenant. Jerusalem had been devastated. The land had been devastated. God's promise, a renewal of the fruitfulness of the land flowing with milk and honey. Then he continues, joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the sound of a melody. Now, this is the idea of weddings and parties and social gatherings. As the physical blessings, the physical fruitfulness and rain and all that was a sign of the blessing of God, the social blessings, marriages, children playing in the streets, singing games, the festivals of Israel with their songs and gaiety, were a sign that God was going to restore the social life of his people. You know, I think this idea that Christianity or biblical faith is a sad, solemn, wear a black hat kind of thing doesn't fit at all with the Bible. Oh, the people of God in the Old Testament danced and rejoiced in God's name. I wish we could catch something of the joy and excitement of the festival atmosphere of the people of God as they worship their God. It'd do wonders for our faith. Now, then in verse 4, pay attention to me, O my people, and give ear to me, O my nation, for a law will go forth from me, and I will set my justice for a light of the peoples. Now, it's very surprising, but of course this is a Hebrew parallelism. The word law and the word my justice are in a parallel relationship. We so misunderstand the rules that God places on our life. We feel like, because of our fallen nature, that rules limit our freedom, that rules are strict boundaries to keep us from really having what we want in life. But in reality, rules are as much God's love as grace. God gives us boundaries for our happiness, for our abundance, for our peace. Let me take an example, the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are really not given so that if it feels good, it's bad. The Ten Commandments are God's way for men to live together in society, each respecting the other's rights and therefore living in a blessed, happy, communal relationship. You see, really, we don't break God's laws. We break ourselves on God's laws. We live in a moral universe. We live in society. We live in community. And the laws of God are meant to help us enjoy community to its fullest, to help us self-actualize to our fullest potential, not to thwart our creativity or our happiness or our joy. How we misunderstand the rules, the law, the boundaries of God are boundaries set in love, not boundaries set in judgmental vindictiveness. Now, let me continue then when it says, and I will set my justice for a light of the people. Notice in verse 5 where it says, the peoples, the coastlands, they. Here is that unique characteristic of the servant songs of Isaiah, of that universal element of the Gentiles being included not only in the blessings of God, but in the very covenant itself they're going to be a part. God's justice is going to be a revelation or a light to the Gentile people. And how even in the New Testament times, many, many Gentiles were so disillusioned with the pagan faith and were attracted by the monotheism and the ethical justice and the beauty of Judaism. It'll be so throughout history. Notice where it mentions, my righteousness is near and my salvation has gone forth. God's saying, now's the time, today's the day, I'm going to bring it about right now. And my arm will judge the peoples. Now, of course, God does not have a body. He does not have an arm. But it's a biblical way of speaking of God's action, God's power, God's might. He's going to do something. He's an action-oriented God. Now, the peoples, the coastlands will wait for me in my arm. They will wait expectantly. There's that universal element that God's going to act not only on behalf of Israel, but on behalf of the world. You see, Israel was meant to be a nation of priests to bring all the world to God. It was never meant to be an exclusivism. It was meant to be an instrument for all the world coming to know the only Creator. Then in verse 6, lift up your eyes to the sky and look to the earth beneath, for the sky will vanish like smoke and the earth will wear out like a garment. The inhabitants will die like gnats, a swarm of gnats. Now here we have the emphasis throughout Isaiah and throughout the Bible on the eternality of God and the transitoriness of man. This idea about heaven and earth passing away is a common biblical theme. You might want to see Isaiah 65:17, Isaiah 66:22, or maybe for a New Testament reference, 2 Peter 3:10. God's going to recreate what he has already made, but without the presence of sin and rebellion. In the last part, my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not wane. Here is that things may in our world may pass away, may come and go. But God's promises, God's word, God's ultimate plan for man will not. You might want to see Matthew 24:35 and Hebrews 1:10-12 for this same paradox put in New Testament terms. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, a people in whose heart is my law. Now, of course, the idea of heart in Hebrew means the entire personality. This reminds me of the new covenant mentioned in Jeremiah 31:31-34, that God's law is not going to be an external thing in rules, but it's going to be an internal thing, an attitude thing, a heart thing. And that's the idea here, that God's people love him from the inside out, not from rules or outside in. And that's very important we see that. Do not fear the reproach of man. Well, if they were they were taken in captivity, their enemies were all around. The enemies had prevailed against them. But God's saying, don't look to man who is here today and gone tomorrow. Don't fear man who can kill the body. Fear God who can kill the soul. And the idea here is trust me. Don't look at the circumstances. Don't look at with fear at those things that are against you. Don't look at the mountains or the giants. Look to me. I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to give you hope. I'm going to renew you. Look to me. That's the idea here. Then he talks about the moth will eat the garments, the grub will eat the wool. Man can destroy some things. Man can destroy earthly things. But look at the last one. But my righteousness shall be forever and my salvation to all generations. How often we get bogged down in the here and now, in this little narrow tunnel vision, instead of seeing the big, marvelous picture of God's grace and plan for man. Take the long look, friend. God's going to work it out. He's in control of history. The circumstances may be bad right now, but friends, God's going to bring justice and love and peace and joy and blessings about. This is not a fair world right now, but God's going to make it fair or the Bible's a lie. Now let's go to chapter 52, beginning in verse 1 and 2. There are a series of imperatives. Awake, clothe, shake, loose. Many people see this beautiful picture of Jerusalem, symbolic of all the people of God, compared with chapter 47, verses 1 and following, the imperatives that command doom on the city of Babylon. So here the city of Babylon, the city of God, are compared. Now the deal about in the last part of verse 1 where it says, for the uncircumcised and the unclean will no more come into you. Now we must remember the larger context. We're not saying that Gentiles won't be a part of the covenant people, because that's been the theme throughout these servant songs. What we're saying is, no uncircumcised alien army will invade you and take you captive again. There'll be no outside invader is what the context demands here, not the fact there won't be any Gentiles included, because they are bidden to come unto the city of God and worship God. So we must take the larger picture here and not proof text the Bible. Verse 2, shake yourself from the dust, rise up. Now, the idea about dust and being laid low was a symbol of captivity. Remember how dust was such a symbol of grief and mourning to the Jew? Well, he used to get up and shake the dust off. A new day is coming. Loose yourself from the chains around your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. Thus says the Lord God, you were sold for nothing, and you'll be redeemed without money. Now, verses 3 through 6, we must remember that there's a change of metaphors here. If you don't realize that we're using these words in a non-normative sense, you're going to really foul up. Redemption is usually seen as buying something back with a cost. It's not saying that salvation is cheap, and verse 5 is really hard to take if you just take it without realizing we're changing metaphors here from the normal use of these words in the Old Testament. Redeemed without money. That is not saying in verse 3 that salvation is like without a cost. What it is saying is that God, Well, let me deal with that first. Redeemed without money. Look at verse 45, verse 13, and verse 55, verse 1. Okay? Verse 4. For thus says the Lord God, my people went down at first into Egypt to reside there, and then to Assyria, oppressed them without cause. Now, Egypt is referring to the captivity, okay, that the Exodus occurred. Assyria was the one that took the northern 10 tribes. Assyria, Samaria, Ephraim. Took those captive in 922 B.C. Assyria did that. Matter of fact, in Isaiah 10, 5 and following, it says, Assyria, the rod of my anger, God says. So God used Assyria as an instrument, as God used Egypt as an instrument. Now, what does it mean, without cause? Well, I think the Bible is going to say that it's because of Israel's sin that these things happened to them. But that is not the sense in which this metaphor here is used. This is not saying that without cause meant that these nations just afflicted the people of God and there was no reason for it. This is looking at it from a different approach than is normally used. Here it's saying the people of God, they weren't as ungodly as these heathen people. The people of God did not deserve what happened to them if you just look at it in the human scales without taking that special divine revelation they had that they violated into account. If you just say, was Assyria a better people than Israel? No, never. And that's the idea that verses 3 through 6 is developing. It's not the normal use of this term. It's a different kind of perspective. Okay? Verse 5. Now, therefore, what do I have here, declares the Lord, seeing that my people have been taken away without cause? Now, there was a cause, and most of the time it says it's because of your sin, Israel, this has happened to you. But here it's looking at it from a different perspective. Okay? Again, the Lord declares, those who rule over them howl, and my name is continually blasphemed all day long. Verse 6, therefore my people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, I am the one who is speaking. Here am I. Now, I want to go to our blackboard just for a minute. You see these different verses that I've listed there, Isaiah 48:11, Ezekiel 20, many verses, Ezekiel 36, and Daniel 9. These are passages where it is so important we realize this. God is acting on our behalf, not because of our righteousness or our goodness, or not because we've been so wonderful. God's going to act because He made a promise, and He's going to keep that promise because of who He is, not because of who we are. God's promises are unconditional. They are conditional on every generation to respond, but they're unconditional as far as who His God is. Now, what does this mean? God did not redeem Israel because Israel was worthy or deserving. God's going to redeem her because God does not want His name to be impugned. Now, the heathen prophet, as you know, ancient battles were in the name of certain deities. And God's name had been dragged through the mud when Israel was taken into exile. They thought God was weak and couldn't protect His own people. And God's saying, my name's been blasphemed because of your sin. I had to punish you, and my name is directly related to you, and I'm being reproached because of you. And so God says, I want to tell you, I'm going to bring you back in the land. But I'm not going to bring you back in the land because you're so good. I'm going to bring you back in the land because of who I am. It's my name's sake that I'm going to act. Now, friends, that is the entire biblical view of the grace of God apart from the merits of man. What God says, all of the Bible is, I'm going to love you because I want to love you. I'm going to love you because of who I am. I'm going to act because of who I am. I'm not going to act because of who you are. I'm not going to act because you deserve it. I'm not going to act because you merit my love. I'm going to act because I'm God, and I'll do what I want to, thank you. So this is the theme, that grace always comes first. God always takes the initiative, and the initiative that God takes is always without strings. So what He's saying here is, I am going to do it, and I'm going to do it because of me, not because of you. And that's such an important biblical doctrine. Now, in verse 7 through 10, we have the beautiful picture of a messenger running up to the city of Jerusalem. Now, this is all in metaphors now, but a messenger is running up to the city of Jerusalem to tell the good news of God's deliverance. And as the messenger comes to the city, the watchman on the wall hears the message that the runner has, and he shouts it to the whole city over the rooftops, and he bids the whole city to join into song and praise of God for what God's going to do. It's a beautiful hymn. So often in these servant songs, Isaiah breaks into singing, and this is one of them. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of Him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, your God reigns. Now, friends, the circumstances of Isaiah's day and the circumstances of the day of the Babylonian captivity did not look like God was in control. In Isaiah's day, Assyria took the northern 10 tribes captive. In Isaiah's prophecy days, Babylon took the very temple ground and leveled the very temple and knocked down the walls of the sacred city. It looked like God was not in control, but the message is God is still king and God is still in control. Friends, the eyes of faith never look at the circumstances of man. It always looks at faith and the power and love and mercy and action of the Creator, Redeemer, God. And that's what this message is all about. God reigns. Now, verse 11. Listen, you watchmen, lift up your voices. Here's the watchmen on the walls of the city begin to shout the good news. They shout joyfully together, for they will see with their own eyes when the Lord restores Zion. Now, not just the city of Jerusalem, but the metaphor here is the entire people of God restored to covenant. Now, verse 9, break forth, shout together, you waste places of Jerusalem. This is speaking about all the people sing joyfully. For the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared his holy arm. Now, God doesn't have an arm. This is an anthropomorphic phrase speaking of God's action or power. Really, it's God's intervention into the historical affairs of man to accomplish God's purpose. Now, in the sight of all nations, that all the ends of the earth may see the salvation of our God. We must remember that God is working in the nation of Israel not because he loves the Jews more than anybody else, but he picked the Jews to reveal his name to all the world. When God blesses Israel, God says something to all the nations. When God gives justice to Israel, he says something to all the world. When God punishes Israel, he says something to the world. Now, friends, here again, God is going to restore the people of God for what purpose? That all the world may come to know God. There is a universal implication. There is a universal purpose in what God's doing with the nation of Israel. We must see that. Now, the word salvation here in the last part of verse 10, in the Old Testament sense, salvation means physical deliverance. In the New Testament sense, salvation means spiritual deliverance. I think there's a combination here. God is going to not only physically restore his people, but he is going to spiritually restore his people. And both are linked together in the book. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.